Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
How's it going, friends? Welcome to Someone Who Isn't Me, episode number 22. My guest on Swim this time is Marilyn Manson. This has been one of the episodes that I've been most looking forward to doing. When I put the list together, I think he was actually probably the first person I put down on the list. I'm a huge fan of his work, but I also consider us to be friends. I view him to be one of the few people that's still part of a long and incredible lineage of rock star artists. People like Bowie obviously spring to mind, and he was a huge influence and friend of Manson's, but those people are few and far between, whether it's because they don't want to take risks quite that way anymore, or whether those artists don't get the chance to express themselves in that way anymore. Who knows? I'm not actually sure. It's not that there isn't great art being made. That's clearly not the case, but it's a rare thing when an artist arrives in the way that Manson did. You know, you could obviously look at a time and place and the impact that he made culturally and say, well, that was because of a time, and since then, you know, he built his legacy and therefore he will continue along that path because of the work he made at that time. I guess that is the case to a certain degree, but this is somebody that I think has continued to make fantastic music that is so layered and nuanced and esoteric that it never fails to impress me. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Anyway, that was the reason why he was the first person on my list when I put together the list of guests that I would like to have on the podcast when I first decided I was going to do this over a year ago. So there have been other interviews that we've done that I was considering putting out for a podcast, and I still have those interviews, but I don't know, it just didn't feel right. But with the release of Heaven Upside Down, which is an incredible album, which I'm still finding more and more amongst it, both sonically and thematically, which is the reason why I hold him in such high regard. But this was the first proper conversation we'd had about that, like where we'd actually sat down and kind of picked through things a little bit. It was recently after he'd broken his leg, so he'd had to move a bed downstairs into his lounge area, and he was resting on the bed when we conducted the interview, and it was awesome. He told me the things he'd been up to recently. He played me some music and some videos, which some of which have seen the light of day at this point. We spoke about the album, the prospect of touring with his leg in the way it was at the time. Since that point, he's obviously played the UK and European shows where he actually integrated it into the show, where there was moments where he was in a kind of motorized wheelchair type device. There was like moments where he was sat on a hospital gurney flanked by doctors. There was weird kind of pirate-esque peg leg thing which he had going on as well, which he just showed me before we started the interview, which had made me laugh. Anyway, so suffice to say, those shows were a triumph, I thought. He was sounding better than I'd heard him in a long time. The show was great. It felt like a reinvigorated live show. And this was all with a broken leg, which is crazy. Back to the interview. We conducted it back in October in Los Angeles. So if the timeline of things seem a little out, then get over it. One of the things that's held this one up is the cover image, the portrait. Just because I like to use reference photos that I take myself, and That took a minute to get together to make that happen, weirdly enough, because I actually forgot to do it at the house when I was there doing the interview. But anyway, thank you to Manson for taking some time to do this. Thank you to Judd as well, and also to Tony, of course, for helping to facilitate the whole thing. This is Someone Who Isn't Me, episode 22, Marilyn Manson.
Where do you want to start?
Your choice.
We should start talking about this first and foremost.
Okay.
Or the album. I don't know. I always feel...
Or the album. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we might as well address...
Because I've not spoken to you since it came out.
Yeah. Let's talk about the album first, and we can talk about the tour and then this, I guess.
Yeah. So, well, firstly, I remember when did I see you? When you were telling me about it, it was in Japan at Knotfest, and you were telling me about titles and stuff, and I'm not sure if the album title had come out as Satan at that point.
I think it had, and at that point we were in the midst of a few festival shows, and Tyler had some obligations with his scoring projects, and I was not aware of how ill my father was. So a few of those things got in the way of the flow that we had, and I think it was for the best. I think it was definitely a fated thing that happened in life, and it occurred greatly with the whole Saturn orbiting the Earth for the first time in 36 or so years. Hmm. I think the last time, I might be wrong, was when Dali died, and strangely, when the week the record came out, was, you know, predicted by Christians to be the end of the world by some in Revelations 12, which is the first song on the record, which had not been written. So there was a lot of different circumstances. Tyler and I got back together, and this album was written, and I can show you the notebooks, quite differently than the others. My thoughts were often scattered through several notebooks, or sometimes channeled, or...
Yeah.
This one was more prose and very specific, and the lyrics to three particular songs were in my notebooks, but they had not found their way onto the record, Heaven Upside Down being the most integral one in telling the story of the record for me, and also Revelation number 12 and... Saturnalia. Saturnalia was a bit of a love letter. Actually, I think a portion of it, about the lyric, when all your demons die, even if just one survives, I'll still be here to hold you no matter how cold you are. That was actually written in a letter, a physical letter, not even an email. Hmm. I wrote to someone who I care about who was in a dark in time of need. I can't remember the last time I've written a letter.
Yeah.
But those three songs, which... You know, for me, it starts, it's the middle, and that's the end of the record. Even though Threats of Romance finishes the album, it's almost, if it were a film, which Tyler and I often referred to it accidentally as a film, but we wanted each song to be a scene of sorts. And realizing that Satan, the song, it looks a certain way when you read it, you know, and you get the play on words and numbers.
Yeah.
But it sounds, it does not translate the same across the board through other languages. It wouldn't have the same impact. And plus, when you just say it in English, it still sounds like Satan.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that would define the record in any way. It would be half of one part. And Heaven Upside Down was what I described the album being to my longtime manager, Tony, because I was asking him, I said, I'm not really sure if I... And we had the same conversation with Pale Emperor, almost in a way, because originally that was going to be called Mephistopheles of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Which I soon found out was another word that people had a hard time pronouncing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But I, when I was describing that record, I... told him, well, this record's mostly about, inspired by this, several different things, but this early Roman leader, they referred to as the Pale Emperor. And he said, that's the perfect title for it. And I thought about it. That was one situation. But this one, when I said, this record is not about heaven or hell, it's about heaven upside down. And the first question was, well, what's heaven upside down? And I said, well, that's what the record is for you to listen to and decide, because it takes you on a bit of a, I guess, on the edge of your seat. And the last song that we finished was Saturnalia. I remember very specifically because it was, we had finished the other two songs, and I said to Tyler, there's just one piece missing, because we had 9 songs. And I said, not just for the sake of having 10, because people expect that, but for the sake of the story, for the sake of the record, there's one thing that I feel is missing. And we both looked at each other, and I said, what song did you ever play to girls when you were in high school that when you wanted to get laid? And we both said at the same time, The Cure, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. And it was almost like stepbrothers, yeah, in a way. And so it started with the concept that I told Tyler. I said, I want the guitar to tell the story as much as I do. And the most unusual and difficult part of that was having all the lyrics, knowing which order to put them in. So in the whole album, I was very specific in how I use pronouns, I and we and they. And it's sometimes looking at the lyrics, maybe being too overcritical, or maybe just being it's very specific about the whole hieroglyphic, the whole painting, the every little brushstroke of everything that I was trying to say with words. I wanted to make sure that I was saying it in a way that would have the proper impact. And that song, this the order of the story, I waited to tell the verses, so to speak, at the end of the song.
Yeah.
And that it took me a series of events. I went to Tyler's, I said we had to write the song, we had this conversation I just spoke of, and I said, can I just take home? So we sat and we made a beat in this hypnotic loop. I brought home and I put it on my stereo here that you just listened to, and it made me have a panic attack because the frequencies of it, because we use a lot of binaural frequencies in an alchemical sense,
yeah,
and in a scientific sense, but I called him right afterwards. I said, this makes me really nervous. And he goes, he just laughed at me. And I said, can we just make it a little bit more tense? I don't want it to be something where you feel nauseated. I want it to be where you are anticipating something and it, where it leaves you scared, but not sick. And we have a communication when we write songs together the way that we do, where I don't have to specify things. I can just tell him an emotion, or most often on this record, he would read my lyrics, whether I was letting him or not. They were on a music stand when we're coming up with something. So we'd sit this far away, you know, he'd have his guitar and his amps pointed slightly away from the mic, but no vocal booth, just us. And then we would later bring in Gil Sharon to play drums on things.
So he was reacting to lyrics.
Yeah. So I went in the next day,
yeah,
and I sang it. And I was looking up things about Saturnalia, you know, the versus Saturnus. And people can, you know, dig as deep as they want about that. But, you know, just the concept of it. Not realizing that Saturn had started this rare, you know, once in our lifetime sort of orbit around the Earth.
Okay.
And they were exhuming Salvador Dali from his grave to try and prove some girl's claim of paternity.
Yeah.
So you've got birth and life and resurrection and all these things happening. And I'm getting this tattoo on my hand of a slightly modified sigil of Lucifer, which has a great deal to do with Saturn and all of my astrological details. And I get a call from my cousin in Ohio saying that my dad is far, far more sick than than I'd been told, because my father was probably protecting me. But again, then you have Saturnus, which is father eating his own child in the circle of life, Ouroboros. And I can only say this looking back. I wasn't at the time putting these pieces together. Now when I look back, I see how important this record was, not for me or as a record to make a hit record or to make something simply as music, but just how important it was to put into the whole universe, the psychosphere of everything. And so I went to Ohio and I was there. I spent about an hour because I'd forgotten that the city, Canton, Ohio, where I was born and grew up, which is the hospital my father was in. He was born there and he died there. I was born there. I don't intend to die there. But I had forgotten that it was a dry county. Now, for people that aren't from America, it meant that in that particular county, they only sold beer, wine, and what they called was diluted vodka. So I drank it. I went, this tastes like water. Because I was trying to prepare myself, because my cousin said, you got to prepare yourself. And this is around noon. So we had to take a little 20-minute trip down the street to get some vodka, and I put in a water bottle. It's my car booze, I guess you would call it. But, you know, I was preparing for something, just seeing him in a way that I wasn't expecting. And I went there, and I saw him, and I got to say, Dad, I love you, and I'm here, and I hugged him. And they took him downstairs to do an MRI, and it was only 30 minutes. During that 30 minutes, and whenever I say anything, if it seems humorous about it, it's the only way I can sort of deal with the sadness of it. But also, my dad would have liked it. And I don't remember if you met my dad, but he would have liked everything that I would be saying right now. They had a crucifix, unlike that one I have up there, which is a proper one, I guess, with the nails through the hands. They had a sort of what I would call more of a sissy Jesus. He just had his arms spread like wings. So I could not resist turning it upside down, of course. Well, I'm waiting for my dad to come back up. And my father came back up from this test. And, you know, I was seeing if he was okay. He went into the bathroom. And then he went into a seizure and he died on the toilet. And all these people rushed in and I went outside and of the room and I was, you know, crying and dealing with it, seeing your father die, seeing it like that was really, and you couldn't do anything about it, is very shocking and upsetting. And then I hear some sort of code, purple or something, come over the loudspeakers in the hospital, and they brought him back to life. So he was in the hospital bed, and he's surrounded by a bunch of nurses and people, and they're putting a tube in his mouth, and I wanted to get in there, and I also wanted to get the vodka that I left in there because I needed it. At that point, I'm like, okay, now he's alive, and I just wanted to talk to him because I didn't get a chance to ask him what he wanted.
Yeah,
you know, ask him if he wanted to be on life support, but I held his hand, and he knew I was there because he squeezed my hand. The other hand, I had my vodka in the water bottle. I didn't even drink it because I couldn't face it. But there's all these nurses around, and, you know, my dad's, it's really painful, I guess, to put this tube down your throat. I can only imagine. And his hospital gown had flipped up a bit and said, Dad, your dick looks amazing. And he squeezed my hand. So I knew that he was still there with me. And he would have wanted me to tell that story. That's my dad. But the next morning I had to he passed away the next morning. And then an hour later Saturn finished its orbit around the Earth. So that seems really strange looking back at it. And after that, I don't know, I don't want to tell you what to ask. I just thought about things that I may have been related to my father that were on the record that I didn't necessarily intend. Maybe they were just in the unconscious mind, I mean.
But then that's the thing, isn't it, about, well, making art is obviously about letting things move through,
mm-hmm.
But then that would also imply that there's a predestined story to unfold. If things are...
Synchronicity and fate and things of that nature.
Of course, yeah,
I mean, it is one of the great questions that always has always gone through my head, you know, after, you know, Christian school and seeing through that and not really buying into that. But during the months that preceded this, I would even say the year that preceded it, I had an increasing number of deja vus, which have not happened as much as since the making of Antichrist Superstar. And I've always really debated over what that could be, if it's messages from the future, if it's a synapse, scientific, you know, mishap in your brain, you know, seeing things or you think you saw it, or if it's an alternate reality, or if it's some part of your unconscious that you haven't unlocked. But I think there's definitely the conscious mind that has to deal with doing something like this, talking about something. That is a subconscious part of me that would write something without thinking about the process of writing it. Then there's the unconscious mind that I think really travels through you and brings in things that are either there or maybe it's a portal. It's a portal to open things up. And that's why I called it Heaven Upside Down, because it's sort of that portal of the unknown. And there's a lot of, I guess, references to not really knowing left, right, up, down, you know, compass, time. You know, I think that...
Yeah, but they're constructs, aren't they?
They are. Calendars, you know. I when people think of a calendar, they think of looking at something straight ahead and it's got a bunch of boxes on it.
Yeah.
And when I see time, I see it in a three-dimensional sense, and it really, I think, either annoys or confuses people that I know or that work for me, because I can't, like when someone says, you're supposed to do this at this time, I can tell what time it is, you know, and on a clock, which I think a lot of people that are younger now don't even know what hands on a clock mean, which is strange. Just like I don't know how to write cursive anymore. I'm not even sure if they teach it. But I see things in a weird like spatial three-dimensional sense where it's almost like looking at it visually, like if it was Mondays right in front of you, then Tuesday's behind it. And
yeah,
so
it's almost like a Rolodex.
Yeah, like a Rolodex. That's a good description. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you in the way you look at time?
Yeah, I find it changes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not always like that.
I think the way that time passes changes depending on what you're doing. I think those moments when you are very much in the flow of things is a way of trying to rationalize it. Say, okay, so when you're in the flow of creativity, I feel that time totally, totally changes. It becomes so elastic.
It disappears almost.
Yeah, I mean, of course. And the whole thing of like, oh, you were lost in a moment. It sounds like a, you know, it's such a flippant comment that people make, but it's...
It sounds it's an outsider true. As a pretentious, or it sounds esoteric, or it sounds like you're batshit crazy. But maybe it's all those things.
Yeah,
but
I haven't got a problem with that though.
I don't either.
You know, I think that is.
Those are all my most charming qualities. I think. But you know, when you paint your paintings, you really capture someone's soul in the most unusual way. That's why I've always loved the detail in yours. And when I got to see the one you gave me in the detail, I can tell you get lost in it.
Yeah.
Mine, I get lost in a really different way, because I tend to see, and there's a name for it. They put a name for anything, where if you look at a wall, I've been staring at this wall because I've been in this bed for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I've been staring at these dents in the wall, and I just see this face in the wall, and it changes every day into something different.
Yeah.
And
pareidolia,
is that what it's called?
Seeing things and having significance of things. But then that's an interesting thing, because when you're on hallucinogenics,
and this was about hallucinogenics.
I get that, but I find that is, you know, when you're coming up on something and things before you're actually, if you're hallucinating, the visualization of things where the geometry and things and the patterning in things becomes so overly exaggerated.
Spatial.
Yeah, when you start to see those things in it. I don't know.
It's, you know, gets into like the power of 10. And that was one of the reasons why that was behind Satan also. Mm. If you've ever read that book. But it's, I don't ever think that I hallucinated when I was on hallucinogens. You know, the only time I've ever hallucinated, I think, well, besides, you know, sometimes I'll see like lights on the other sides of my eyes. And, you know, some people believe those are different, you know, alien beings, or maybe it's just hallucinating, but, and you know, smears and things that people try to replicate on film, and they're rarely ever accomplish that. I think that lack of sleep deprivation probably would give you the most hallucinations than anything.
Yeah.
Thus, you know, the New Testament, the visions of John the Baptist, Revelations.
Yeah.
If you go in the woods for 40 days and don't eat and don't sleep, you're going to see shit.
Yeah.
Now, does that make it real or not? I don't know, but it's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Because it's not always about...
I read a thing, there's a book by Rick Strassman who did, I don't know if you've read that book, The Spirit Molecule, about DMT.
No, but it's something that interests me.
So he wrote a book about that one, and it was about all the clinical trials that they started conducting. Mm. But he wrote a book after that, and it's I can't remember the title properly, but it's something along the lines of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And he's basically gone through different parts of the Bible going, so the visions of each person was due to different things like psychoactive substances
I mean it's you can imagine what they're eating.
They're saying it was acacia and that has like a really high
what is that exactly?
Acacia.
Is that the memory berries?
No, acacia is a plant which has a really high DMT content in it.
I didn't know how to pronounce the word, except it always reminds me of 22 Acacia Street by Iron Maiden.
Yeah. But then it's funny because in Masonic lore as well, like when, without going into it too much, the main story is like somebody is buried in a shallow grave with a sprig of acacia by his head to mark the grave. And it just seems like it's a plant which keeps appearing in different stories.
Yeah, that's
anyway,
it's
totally taken off.
It's okay. The tangents are good, and it's everyone else's fault for listening to this. Mm. It's like a podcast can be more like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's one of those pod people, so we're infecting everyone.
Yeah,
it's going viral, but in a different way. So tell me what you thought about the record. I'm interested to hear about because we haven't talked about it.
What, you want me to break it down and what?
No.
I think it's fantastic.
Thanks.
I think it makes...
I hear the details that you think.
What, things that jumped out at me?
No, just you as a musical person that...
Well, I'm sure we've discussed this before, but when I listen to things, I can't... I enjoy them on first listen, but at the same time, I'm over-analyzing everything. Mm-hmm. And I start picking everything apart, and I'm trying to find lyrical references and what this might be about, but also in the same sense with the actual music as well. Like things like in Kill For Me, the lead guitar line has such a like a Joey Santiago from early Pixies mm-hmm. record feel to
all
it.
Right.
And I start, and I can't help but do that. It's like I'm kind of picking through things, and I think... all the points that whether they were chosen points to reference within a musical history, like it ticked all those boxes for me.
That's really interesting because you said that because when Tyler Bates and I sat down before we wrote anything, we sat down. You have to remember we had a little bit of a tiff before we got back together, and then we got over that because. I probably spent more time with him than anybody else in my life, which is sounds, you know, very specific, and you know, I'm sure that it affects his both of our lives. But we sat down, and I said, "Well, let's are we gonna do something?" And he said, "Let me ask you a question. Do you like Killing Joke, right?"
Yeah.
No, that's what he said to me.
Yeah.
I said, "Of course I do." I go, "That's I think that's where I broke my foot the first time when some skinhead stomped on it when I saw them play with Ministry in Miami Beach." And then he just put up a simple just kick drum and he started playing a riff, and I said, "Turn the mic." I put on my headphones and I pulled out my notebook because I already had the words written.
Yeah.
Just and thus became "We Know Where You Fucking Live." It just came out of right out of the brain. He's just like playing, and then I'm singing along with him, and it just erupted. And then we built on it, but
yeah,
it built on. Well, that's we just said we wanted to make music that was like the music that we listened to, that brought us to where we were. We didn't want to be trying to redo something, but the fact that it has those little tinges, I think that appeals to, you know, us making it. And if it hits you, someone who's heard that music, and then if it hits someone who has never heard that music, because you know there was a sense of being afraid to we were not in any way trying to sound like my earlier records, but then I realized, and I had to go back and listen to my
earlier
records.
There's real moments on there that really
and I thought, you know what, this doesn't sound like I remember it sounding, because maybe in my head I painted it different, you know, because when you want to get to that point in your career, sometimes people get to that point where they make that fucking record that really changes things, like Scary Monsters for Bowie. That was like a big game changer, but that was so long down the road in his career. And sometimes you make that terrible record that does a bad thing. And you know, I think that I made some records that were still in the vein of what I wanted to be, but they just did not have the one missing ingredient. I think I owe that to Tyler Bates. He's got that missing ingredient that we had this chemistry,
yeah,
where he could read me like a character, because I am like I live life like it's a movie, you know. I'm sitting here now, but you know, we're being real. It's not like I'm putting on a pretense for you or something. This is what it is. But with us, we don't want anything less than perfect, and perfect in our way, not perfect in the conventional sense that other people might think is perfect. I was amazed that the record label wanted to, I thought they were joking when they said, "Yeah, we want to give you money to make a video for We Know Where You Fucking Live, and there's nuns with a mortar launcher." And I just thought, what world have I just said to Yeah. And it, but it's important, and it's not just shocking. It's, I mean, how it's not even a point. It's, it goes back to the beginning with the name Marilyn Manson. It's, it couldn't be shocking then. Never was meant to be. But now, I mean, in one way, it makes me the ambassador of intelligence for America, with the government and everything that's going on a daily basis. But it always has, you know. I always thought art thrived under, you know, Bush and things like that. But, you know, it seems like these are dangerous times, but they've always seemed like they're dangerous times.
Yeah.
Maybe more so than now, but maybe it's just more televised or just more talked about because of the internet. I think it makes it a more important time for art. And not, it's not, I thought a lot about things like vinyl and how younger kids are really into vinyl. And I still have all my vinyl that I kept, you know, when I bought vinyl. Now I just play it once and record onto cassette so it'd be pristine.
Yeah.
I think it's more that I identify more with something like 1984 or like my Hollywood novel that I wrote that I plan on doing something with finally this year.
Yeah.
Or next year, rather, because it's the end of this year. Just the nostalgia. We're living in such an ephemeral era. People will forget about something that happened yesterday.
Yeah.
By next week, you know, something happened in my band, you know, that occurred with my bass player, and I had to you know, split ways with my one of my best friends for many years, and I can't say I'm not still his best friend. The circumstances were not, they weren't in the right way, so I won't get into more detail than what I already said.
Yeah.
But then the next day, my original guitar player dies, and it's a lot to absorb, but to the outside world, that's just a headline that they read.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I read it, it just sounds so callous.
Yeah.
You know? Found dead, or just, you know, just so it's, you know, which is why I never wanted to continue on in that, well, I would never have been in that realm of journalism, but just in the more investigative, personable, like what you do,
yeah,
talking to people, and getting inside and opening it up, letting people hear it.
Yeah. And it just feels like we're at a point now where it's just flying past. Like you say, it's like next. And there's no actual absorption of any kind of information. It's just, as you said, it's just headlines. It's like when lives are reduced to sound bites, it's just horrendous.
You have to adapt, though. You have to adapt and evolve from it. You can't be a curmudgeon and think, well, I want it to be my way. And I've got friends that are like that, you know. Corgan and I often get in arguments, not arguments, debates. I wouldn't even say debates, but just conversations about,
yeah,
why don't people listen to this because it's great. And that could be said from either one of us. So I'm not saying he said that. I'm saying you have to figure out how to make them listen to it.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of great things that have never been seen or heard.
Yeah.
But there's another element of artistry that is the P.T. Barnum element that knows how to reach the heart of the people that you want to reach if you want to. If you want to be someone who I would consider more, I guess, self-consumed, or just it's doing something. You can be someone who wants to do something just for yourself, and then someone discovers it. A lot of people who are like that, artists that don't really want to be famous or known. And I, you know, I'm not saying I didn't want to be famous in the beginning. I just wanted to be in a position where, one, probably the childish version of me wanted to have a fuck you to all the people who didn't believe in anything that I wanted to do,
yeah,
in general, from my parents to, you know, everyone in high school, just like anybody else in the world.
Yeah.
Not any different than anyone else. Then there's the other part of me that wanted to do something that changed or made a dent in the way people do things. I wasn't trying to say that rock and roll can change or save the world, but we do have to recognize the impact it's had on our lives. So
yeah,
it can't change things that are out of our hands, like politics and the environment or the ecosystem. You know, animals are always going to be animals. People are always going to be there's going to be staples and things that are always going to be the way they are. We're not trying to change those, but we're adding something to the world,
yeah,
rather than taking it away. And that's what we always fight against. The people want to take things out of the world. Religion, politics, they're just trying to take things away, either money or power or whatever it might be. They're sort of all-consuming. Technically, the definition of psychopaths are corporations, because they have no care or concern for what they devour.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Which is why great art obviously flourishes in those times, because it's not only a reaction to those things, but it's a necessity. You know, like as you were saying, in a universal sense, those things come through because they need to. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's like a calling.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a calling. I felt like that's why I would get this tattooed on my hand. I felt it was a calling to be like, there needed to be me, the me that I chose to be. You know, I'm not trying to be someone that I'm not. That's what I did when I started Marilyn Manson. Mm-hmm. I didn't like who I was, so I decided to be something better and different for whatever scale of better, good, evil, you know, under my terms, something better and different. Now I have to realize that I need to be who I am, and I need to be strong at it, and I need to be good at it. And while I got a major ankle injury, I consider it a minor setback because I feel so determined about this record.
Yeah.
And it's not in the same way that, you know, when you put out a record, of course you want to promote it and you want to say you love it, and because it's new, you know, you being an artist, you now understand that usually something you do, the most recent thing you've done is in your head and it's most recent and you love it the most.
Yeah.
I don't think of it that way always. You know, I think that this record is one of the most important records I've done. I don't know still if it's my favorite record musically that I can listen to, because there's bits and pieces of everything. Hollywood will always still be one of the most important pieces of music for me to listen to. It's so always difficult, but it has so many layers of memories to it.
Yeah.
And it's odd, the JFK revelations that I guess Trump released. I haven't seen that, but you know, it was such an obsession of mine at the time of making that. But
yeah,
this record, strangely, I think it's obvious that people could see things as political about it. It was not intended to be something that was a reaction to politics as much as any other thing that I've ever done. Maybe just my commentary on America, but not current America only.
Yeah.
It's just too obvious.
Feel like a cheap shot if you were just...
Yeah, the thing that I did, the video that I released on Election Day, which then that guy, who shall remain nameless, redid the same thing but in a piss poor way and ruined people's careers. But I never said it was anything other than what you wanted it to be. And I also very much made it before the election.
Yeah.
Which was just common sense. But it was my opinion on voting. And I voted once, and that was for Barack Obama the first time. Just because I think I actually was awake that early and someone encouraged me to. That's probably, you're lucky you live in a monarchy. So.
Yeah.
So you wanted to talk about my ankle, I'm sure.
I saw the video. Well, there was the two videos, and it's...
I haven't watched them because...
It just seemed so ill-timed because you put out the album and it's... Pale Emperor was... made such a clear statement about you as an artist for a lot of people. You know, if we're being real, I think a lot of people probably were like, we're moving on, we're on to this now. As we said earlier, people were like, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing.
Right, right.
And I don't want to sound like I'm kissing your ass.
No.
But please do. But the thing is, the great artists will always... keep
39 steps ahead.
Yeah. and that record really, really proved that. And so there was a lot riding on it. It was almost like
it was almost like a sophomore record, this one.
Yeah.
In a sense, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it was a rebirth, because I had to say to myself, I am not the person, the artist that I should be right now. So I had to say, you know, this is a comeback or this is a rebirth. But in my head, I had to admit that. I had to have the, you know, I had to break down and be humble enough about it. Maybe it was also because, you know, at the same time I was, you know, branching into doing Sons of Anarchy, so I was open to dropping, you know, being humble, like being not in control of everything.
Yeah.
And the Tyler Bates and I have gotten to a point, strangely enough, when we finished Pale Emperor, and this had to be over 3.5 years ago, he said to me, well, just wait, this is just the opening act for the next album, not even knowing what we were going to do. But we have this communication that's almost Bluetooth and mental, where we always seem to be traveling on the same path and wanting the same thing. And
it's a rare thing to find that person.
It is.
And it's something that needs, I mean, it's blatantly apparent to the people involved that when that happens, that it's more than just like, oh yeah, we can write together. It's way more than that.
It's far more than that, because I think that on this record, what stands apart from it is, it may seem more, I don't know, it's hard to say. The last record, if we were to use the definitions that were in reviews and things like that, was more rock and roll, and it was blues, or it was more about me being a singer and things, you know, the things that they said about that record. And I thought it was more me just getting my confidence back as being a rock star and being me.
Yeah.
This record was me enjoying being me and having a full-blown attitude with the, you know, foot on the gas pedal and not stopping at any stoplights and not questioning anything. And it wasn't me doubting myself by changing the title. It was just me knowing, wait, I passed something on the way by there. And I need to go back there and get that and finish the story. And we were so happy when we were done. And we were very specific to the point where Tyler, he would say, well, I changed something in the mix of this song. And I said, well, do you like it? He said, yeah. And I said, do you love it? And he would say, yeah, I do. I said, well, I'm good. I don't need to hear it. I trust you. That's the kind of trust that we had, because I know that he wants the same thing that I want. And that's a hard thing to develop in a musical relationship.
Yeah.
In fact, it's probably what destroys most musical relationships. It's... he, you know, I think that we bring a lot to each other, and it sounds very intimate, because it is, and it made this record something that I didn't realize had so many layers to it until I went back. I didn't realize the layers of the lyrics that it had, because I didn't realize that some of the phonetics of the way I spoke the words, being American, and the just like the way I pronounce words, it sounds like something else to other people if you don't have the lyric sheet.
Yeah.
And it's
interesting as well, because to make something and then go back and find all these other elements within it is only testament to it being a great piece of art, right? Because if you sit and great art is made when you sit and you think about those layers and the different aspects of everything, you know, lyrically, references. Then when you move on to the visuals of what's going to be involved, to the videos, to the changing of colors within certain scenes, you can sit and do all that, and that you can make great art that way as well.
That would be a total mind fuck for me to try to do it that way.
But when something is intuitive, that's when you know
the unconscious.
As you said, when you're in the flow of it, when you're riding that whole, when you're riding it, that's when you know that it's a great work.
It's strange, because I truly don't like to listen to a record that I've done over and over again, And only because you've heard it when you're making it. But I didn't really hear this record that much when I was making it, because a lot of the vocals, I just knew what I wanted to do, and I would go in and do it. And Tyler would not, he wouldn't accept anything less than exactly what he thought should be it. And it was only, I think, one song that I went back and I re-sang it after, because it had been sitting for about 5 months. Because of the delay with my father and all that. And it wasn't after my father, it was before that, but just, it was something that I heard and I went back and I re-sang it, and it was the song Jesus Crisis. Because there's a specific way that I sing the, I write songs to fight and to fuck too. Is it's a bit of, especially where it falls on the record, it could be taken a bit, you know, more on the sarcastic side, like I don't like the drugs type of statement, but I say it almost as a matter of fact resume, like, what did you expect? But it's just, and that song has a lot, that has a lot of tones in it that remind me of stuff that I loved listening to, like Girls Against Boys, and you know, some of the, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like what's the band that I'm trying to think of? You probably help me on it. Sort of the early noise rock, not Sonic Youth, but that revolved around that era of, you know,
like an Amphetamine Reptile band. On
yeah,
that label.
Yeah. That type of stuff. You know, just where it has a dirtiness to it that, and then there's a point in the record where it goes into this spastic moment, and then it goes into halftime with the chant of Jesus Crisis. And I said to Tyler, because we were doing the song, and I said, I just want to do this because I don't want to have not done this ever in my career.
Yeah.
I want a moment where it sounds like you accidentally snorted crystal meth instead of cocaine. Can I run the Pro Tools? Which he, it's just me and him, and he does so much, but it's just part of it, his instrument, it's just the way he works.
Yeah.
And so he let me sort of sketch out, it goes into this spastic chaos of cutting up all these different parts. And then it just breaks down into this pause, and then Jesus Crisis, that part, which I think is one of the heaviest, most intriguing parts on the record, and his daughters sing on it too, and they both the two daughters, and there's a few other girls, they're schoolmates, I believe, and they all go to a Hebrew school, which the Jesus Crisis then takes on a whole brand new irony. So we thought that was appropriate, but he would not let his daughters listen to the rest of the song, so they didn't hear the profanity, they just heard the Jesus Crisis part. And then I said to Tyler, I said, I'm really interested to see how you're going to get out of this halftime part.
Yeah.
And he did, just with the But then it just comes back. It could come back screaming, but it comes back with the same sort of attitude, like, yeah, this is what I do. It's just with, it's like it's got a real Richard Butler kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, in a weird way. I liked seeing him once, Psychedelic Furs, back in the day when he sat in a big velvet chair, which I'm probably going to need to do something of that nature probably for a couple shows, where he just was just, oh, my way. It's not monotone, but it's just like, it's very, I think probably for, you know, some, you know, especially for girls, I think it's got that whole attitude of the guy, the James Dean, foot on the wall, smoking a cigarette, fuck you kind of attitude.
Mm.
It wasn't necessarily that's what I was going for, but probably that's what I was going for.
How was it doing these songs and shows before the accident?
It was great, actually.
Because we did
three or four.
Yeah, prior to the album even coming out.
Yeah, and there was a bit of a, I think I saw a nervousness in the management and in the record label, and I said, look.
Yeah, it was a ballsy move.
They said, well, you know, we just don't want bad versions of it being out there. And Tyler Bates said, there won't be a bad version of it. That's his attitude always.
Yeah.
And I just liked it because there's an element to the record that I really love that we did intentionally, but we didn't sit down and write a mathematical equation about it. There is an immediacy of the rhythm and of the musical tones and the keys and the melodies that if you hear for the first time, it's the same as if you sit in a movie theater and you're watching a movie and it opens up and it's great, you're on the edge of your seat waiting to see what happens next. Hmm. That's what I think the record feels like. If you listen to it in an album form, which is not necessarily the tradition now, but then you take each song separately and each song within itself has a bit of a build, like a series of short scenes.
Yeah, it's like a
mise-en-scene or whatever you want to call it. There we go.
Well, it's that was as something above, so below, isn't it? It should be that as a greater, like the macrocosm of the record.
Well, that's side A and side B, above and below.
Yeah.
That's what I made it, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like Portrait of an American Family was side A was mom, side B was dad. That's what was above and below.
So what's going to happen with these shows now?
Well,
because it's not long.
It's not long at all.
Ten pins.
So what happened was I blacked out a bit when it felt. A lot of people think that I was trying to climb it. I was just trying to hold on to it because it wasn't secured.
Hmm.
And it started to fall. So when it looks like I'm trying to climb it, I'm trying to hold it back up.
Hmm.
And luckily, I somehow got out of the way because I realized it was way too heavy to hold up. And I twisted my leg sideways and just broke my fibula in two places. At the time, I just blacked out at that moment from just the utter pain. And for 5-10 seconds, I'm not really sure. And, you know, I've broken my foot before and continued to show or something, but this was unbearable. I mean, it was really, it was so unbearable I stopped feeling it, you know, when it just goes through your body so much that you just can't think. So they're rushing me out, still in my clothes and makeup. And I go to the emergency room, I'm in an ambulance, every bump hurt like a motherfucker. But they're asking me all these questions and my head's just spinning. And then I finally get into a room, and this guy comes in. This, I guess he was a nurse, to take my blood and stuff. And he had a strange lisp, so it sort of sounded like Mike Tyson. He's like, now normally we would take this and we would put like a plate in it, but because if we let it wait, it will swell up, and then we can't throw it shut. But we found trace amounts of cocaine in your body. So we can't put you under anesthesia. But it seemed like they didn't even have a chance to do that. I think they just looked at me and said that. I don't know the timeline because I was a little dizzy. But so then I was in New York for a few days and was waiting for it to be safe to fly because I could get something, some compression thing that could kill you in and of itself. Came back, waited a week, got a surgery, which... they put 10 pins in a plate in my ankle, which will stay there forever. And the wound itself is pretty much healed. I'm learning to walk on different types of devices. I've tried to change the show around to make it still be exciting and not be something where I just sit down.
Yeah.
I can't do that. Just it's not my nature. If I have to have, you know, men holding me, you know, like, or like a kneeling device from a, whatever I have to do, I'm going to make it work for me. I'm definitely at crutches made out of AR-70 machine guns. I thought that would be the least I could do. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to use them as crutches because it's really difficult to sing with crutches.
Yeah.
So I have a mic stand that has a bit of a kneeler.
So how many shows?
We have a
European tour, right?
Yeah. I'm not really supposed to be back on my feet. Like, I can't really stand on it for another 3 weeks or so, but it's healed a lot faster because I took a lot of holistic medicine that that Billy Corgan gave me as a gift. I don't know if alcohol cancels that out. Chances are yes or no, but it has healed properly. If I just put it in a cast, it would have taken 3 months.
Yeah.
But this healed.
But you worried that if you go out, you'll do more harm to it?
No, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to Mad Max the fuck out of this thing, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, just get my leg made of titanium. This is made of titanium, so that's good. Titanium.
And what have you been doing while you've been laid up?
Watching a lot of cinema, reading a lot of books, doing a lot of writing.
Yeah.
You
been painting?
I can't paint because I paint on my knees. Okay. I did get knee pads, so I might be able to paint now. Because that's actually the most preferable way to get around with all the stairs. That's why I'm downstairs, because I have to. But crawling, I can crawl on my knees.
Yeah.
So I'm like a wild, feral toddler crawling up the stairs looking for books and things like that. But I haven't tried to paint. But
So you paint kneeling? Mm-hmm. Like, so the paper flat?
Yeah, because of watercolors. I don't want it to. And I also have to sort of tilt it and blend it. So there's a strange ritualistic quality to what I paint. And I only discovered, I don't get it in some sort of crazy trance more than maybe just late night, obsessive, potentially drunkenness, but not so much drunk, because you can't function well when you're drunk.
Hmm.
You know, you just can't. You can't focus. But sometimes you need to loosen up at the least. But I will get in the middle of something, and I won't really know, because it's watercolor, how it's going to be until the next day.
Yeah.
And because I've used a lot of ink as of late, it dries differently. But I have a few pieces upstairs that are really interesting that happened right before I left to go on tour. They're not exactly what I intended.
Yeah.
But they ended up being more interesting. So I've been doing a lot of drawing, in my big notebooks and stuff like this, but which I like, and that's kind of the size that you use, isn't it? So I've been trying to perfect my roots of drawing. I found recently some of my early sketches from high school, like Iron Maiden, Power Slave, and Jim Morrison pencil sketches and stuff like that. But which were pretty good with stippling and shading and stuff.
Do you find that when you're making visual art, you're in a different mindset from when you're making music?
It's always quiet. I don't listen to anything. It's silent.
Huh.
In my art room, I paint it entirely black so that there's no reflections of any light. It's definitely different. And with the videos that I released, the three, and you just saw the new one, Kill For Me, I would say that they're collaborative, and that I approach them more like still being myself as a performer, a singer. They weren't like stepping out of myself to being my only version of Halloween, technically, is acting in movies, because I get to be someone other than me.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean just washing off lipstick or something, because there's not really that big of a difference, except that on stage I have a microphone in my hand, and they're strangers. But Bill Jukic, the guy who directed them, we go way back, because he was on tour with me during In the Thick of It, 1996, and he and I both, I guess, I won't point fingers at him or me, but let's just say that Bill kind of Bill wanted to fight a co-ed high school soccer team that was staying in our hotel.
Okay.
The hotel was connected to the venue. It ended up with fire, and so when he said, he approached me with the treatment, the script for We Know Where You Fucking Live, and the first sentence said none, mortar launcher, I knew A, his pyrotechnic skills were tight, okay, and I know B, if he can get the record company to pay for this, I'll be amazed. I thought it was actually a prank, but he took a different level. He took a different approach on the videos than I would have, And it was good to collaborate with someone who had an outside point of view, because I would have done something entirely different for both videos.
Yeah. But then this is the upside of the death of music television.
Yeah.
Because now it doesn't matter. Whereas videos that would have got made back when that was the source and the outlet.
Yeah.
Where they're going to dictate their own morals.
Yeah.
Upon what can be seen and can't be seen, then you have to conform to that, and you know.
I kind of got past that a long time ago in a way, but I think this was different for me because I started to develop an attitude about where I didn't want to give a specific storyline or image about a song. It came from me to someone watching it, so I was very, very comfortable with having someone tell me like their idea and giving them full rein, and me just being, tell me what to do and I'll do it. It's like, be yourself, do your performance. You know, it wasn't someone telling me how to perform. It was just like someone coming up with a story other than me, which I've traditionally always done the story form. And it was the new form of, it wasn't the censorship part, it was a new idea of, okay, so we're in a world where people identify with things on a short term, so it wasn't watering things down, it was just keeping things interesting, and they poke at your mind, because we were talking about the Kill For Me scene. I'm watching it and I'm not even sure what's happening in it. And I was in it. So I'm not sure which ass is mine and which ass is Johnny Depp's and which ass is someone else's. So it sounds funny to get, you know, but having been friends with Johnny for so many years, we always said, why haven't we done anything together? And he said he was too shy to ask me. He said, really? Come on, give me a break. And he was. I mean, he's that sweet like that. But I just thought I had fun doing it. All three videos that we did for this record so far, I've had fun doing. I'm having fun doing this interview. I don't like to do shit that's not fun. Life's too short.
Yeah.
That's that simple. There doesn't need to be like any more tag on to that statement.
Yeah.
And I enjoy doing this record because, and it can be angry. You can enjoy being angry. It's not angry all the time. I think that it's just expressive. I think this record is most like me as a person. I don't know. What do you think? Because you know me.
Yeah,
I agree. It has the pattern of speech that I use. I mean, of course, when you're writing something, I don't really tend to rhyme that much.
But then do you think that? Yeah, I agree with that. But do you think that that's representative of you now? Do you not think that when you did Antichrist, that was representative of you then?
Well, in the sense that we're talking about alternate things in the cycle and the concept of, it makes me, I, you know what I think is similar to when I did Antichrist? The fire in me, the need to do it.
Yeah.
It's a need. It's not like an anger, it's a need. It's like a craving, like you have to do it.
Yeah, it's like a compulsion.
You feel like you're looking at this, like on my wall, like it's a screensaver, it says, you're like, mine, I see that and I just want to burn it. Just because, not because I hate it, just is like my nature. Yeah. It's almost a childish urge. Maybe it's, you know what, it's to see what happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's just to, I'm often amazed by what I get away with. Musically, visually, just in general.
Yeah.
And that's not always my purpose, but it's great to be able to get I think what I've learned most over, like, since I made Pale Emperor was I'm not afraid to collaborate. Before, when we talked about jamming, and I said, like, that's a word that's alien to me because I don't know how to jam, because I was never in a band where I would, you know, wasn't that type of a band. And it's more collaborating. Like, I like to have someone else's opinion that I didn't tell them what I want, because then it's polluted so they can add something to it. And that makes me happy. It's just, I can always go back to comparing it to painting. Obviously, we both paint differently, but painting has a separate purity from music that is just the same as it's separate from, you know, writing a song is different than performing a song.
Yeah.
They're all different, but in the same sense as Dali, I guess, not comparing myself to Dali, but comparing the concept of being art, yeah, in and of yourself, that everything you do, you know, it doesn't mean that everything I do is art. It just means everything I do is me. It is different levels of me. I don't, you know, I'm not always, just like anyone, you know, you're not always wearing shoes, you know, whatever example you want to use.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's still the same person. And this person is what I've decided to be a long time ago. So now I want to enjoy it. And despite having a year that was a little bit challenging, you know, a lot challenging to say the least. Mm. I seem pretty calm, calmer than you are, dude. You know,
yeah,
pretty calm and pretty just optimistic because I enjoy doing it. And I think it's a time when, you know, you're seeing all these people fall. You know, so many people. You know, I don't know if it's because of the time that we're in where it's more publicized or it's more apparent because of, you know, social media or any sort of internet coverage, or if it's just that we've grown to an age, you and I, that people, you know, that you grew up listening to eventually are not going to live forever, just, yeah, like your parents aren't, things like that.
Hmm.
But I have a great determination to not expire anytime in the near future because I have too much work to do.
Yeah.
Too much more to enjoy. Too many more interviews to do with you.
Thank you for listening to Someone Who Isn't Me, episode 22. That was Marilyn Manson. You can find him on socials, obviously, which is just at Marilyn Manson. I am at Daniel P. Carter on Twitter and Instagram. The album Heaven Upside Down is out now. He's going to be back in the UK, if you're listening there, by the way. He's going to be back in the UK for Download Festival. I'm going to try and get out to one of the European shows before that, though. I'm also excited at the prospect that the Hollywood novel is going to finally see the light of day in 2018. It's been a long time coming, obviously. The next episode of Someone Who Isn't Me is going to be with either Cedric Bixler-Zavala of At the Drive-In, The Mars Volta, etc., or Andrew WK, both of which I think are brilliant conversations. I enjoyed them equally. I apologize if you find that the podcast is a little too infrequent for your liking. I realize that a lot of people that have podcasts have a lot more of a driven work ethic with them, but for me these are just simply an excuse to have an inspiring conversation with an artist that I really respect. I hope you get that from the episodes, and if it means that it's a case of quality not quantity, then, you know, so be it. I just do this for the love of it, if I'm honest. Thanks for listening. If you could spend a minute of your time leaving a review and a 5-star rating on something like iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use to enjoy this, that would be much appreciated. Thanks again. I'm out. Peace.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.